Well, that is Lookout Mountain Showdown from earlier this year on this very show. Lookout Mountain Showdown joins Frank Martin, the Caleb Dean Band, a band called Alexis, the Smuggler Mountain Boys, the Valley Bluegrass Jam, and the Defiant String Band to play the Spring Creek Uprising Music Festival tomorrow at the Gianetti Spring Creek Ranch right here in Carbondale at 601 Cowan Drive over there near the dog park. It's a day-long showcase of local music starting at noon, and it all benefits Youth Zone. This is your chance to support both local music and local youth at the same time. It's BYOB and BYO Picnic. Well, hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler. America at Heart, Behind the Shutter, celebrates the colors, characters, and contours of America's West, captured through photography by Michael Fain, Tom Coralogos, Catherine Rabinow, Gail Waterman, and emerging artist Devin Poole, with an artist's reception tomorrow, September 9th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Coralogos Gallery in Basalt. Ann Coralogos says this group of photographers captures both the mysticism and true grit realism of the West, from Waterman's macro perspective of its antiqued surfaces to Poole's larger-than-life landscapes to the mystic minimalist black and whites of Fain to the journalistic realism of Coralogos to the double-take abstracts of Catherine Rabinow. There will be something for everyone to enjoy. Well, Devin Poole, one of the featured artists, joins Express Yourself today. Devin recently won the landscape category of the second annual Aspen Photo Challenge, as well as the peer favorite category. Devin has also been named one of the top nine Colorado Instagrammers by Out There Colorado. His work has been shown at the Bird's Nest Gallery in Aspen and has benefited with his photos, Protect Our Winters, a leading climate advocacy group for the winter sports community. And now comes his part in the new show at the Coralogos Gallery. Devin Poole, welcome to KD&K.
Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. Are you happy with that show at the Coralogos Gallery?
Very happy with the show.
How so? What makes it good for you?
Well, being included with that group of photographers is an honor for me. As it says in the introduction, I'm an emerging artist. I am new to the scene, and so being included with this group is a real honor, and I'm lucky to be there.
Mm. So did you picture this when you first started, so to speak, did you picture this when you first started your photography career? Did you see these kinds of things happening?
Not at all. My photography career sort of sprung out of nothing, almost. I never intended to be a professional photographer necessarily. I just loved photography, and I traveled the wilderness often, and I was photographing my travels, and then it turned into something that other people enjoyed seeing, and then now it's turning into something that people would like to pay for.
So you have a lot of experimenting behind you.
I do, yes.
Huh. Did you go to school to study?
I did not go to any photography school. I started playing with the camera maybe 8 years ago, to the point where I was taking a lot of photos, and then I started to hone in, my eye for it. And initially it was all for me just to remember my trips. And then I started realizing that I wasn't able to capture what I wanted to capture with the equipment that I had. So I invested in upgrading my equipment, and then read a few books, really. And it just clicked. I understood everything I was reading almost instantly, got out there and started practicing, and it came really naturally.
Hmm. Do you remember those first few photographs where you went, I might keep doing this. This is really cool.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was a lot of iPhone photos initially that I realized I was able to capture a beautiful photo with just an iPhone.
Uh-huh.
And so, they say that the best camera for the photo you want to take is the one you've got. So, but I realized I needed better equipment than I had, and that's where it really took off from there once I upgraded.
Well, I know iPhone exhibitions are a thing.
Yeah.
Somewhere down the road, I guess we'll see a Devin Poole iPhone exhibition. Huh?
Maybe so. Yeah.
So you've spent lots of time in the local wilderness areas to great effect. I mean, I've gone to your website, which is devinpoolphoto.com, and checked out those pictures and just was dumbfounded. What's the secret? I know that you like that big vista and you like the unique perspective. So how do you approach? Do you think of a photo before you take it? I mean, way before you take it? Or is it all serendipitous?
Absolutely. I think a lot about it before I take it. Whenever I have a trip planned, I look at maps and I sort of think about what different spots in a valley or on a hillside might give me as far as perspective on a lot around here, a lot of commonly photographed areas. But I realized, you know, I have a drive to get to places that people haven't been. And a lot of times I actually kind of almost dream of the photo prior to,
oh really,
to getting out there. So I almost see it in my head before I actually even get there. And then from there, it's just thinking about the timing of the light, the sun, the moon, the stars, where everything's going to be at the right time, and try to be there for that moment.
You like low light situations.
I do. I like low light. I think it's an attractive light. I think the more light you have, the more similar it looks to other things. And so whenever you experiment with the low light stuff, you can bring out light that our eyes actually don't even see, but the camera can capture that light.
Oh, interesting. So some of those pictures we were looking at together before the show from your website, how does that manifest, that idea that the camera's capturing things that the eye isn't seeing?
With a longer exposure, obviously our exposure setting for our eyes would be an instant.
Okay.
You can't change the amount of time that light is absorbed into one moment with your eyes. But with the camera, you can have it capturing light for 30 seconds and just absorbing. And then the finished product is one single moment of 30 seconds of captured light by a very advanced piece of equipment, the magical little black box that is our camera.
Uh-huh. You're shooting all digital, right?
All digital, yeah. Uh-huh. Canon.
Okay. Do you ever shoot single lens reflex at all?
I do. I have three film cameras.
Huh.
I want to shoot more than I do with film. I just have my hands full with the digital side of things as it is, and that would add a lot more time. And so,
yeah,
we think we have all the time in the world, but we don't always.
So it works. Well, I guess that would add a whole another layer of toxicity to the process dealing with a darkroom.
Yeah, but it also takes you back to the roots of photography itself. Most of what you learn in digital photography is the same as what you do on film. A lot of the same techniques and everything are used. And so I think if I did do it, it would improve my digital photography in the end. And so I'm working towards it. I have the stuff to do it and just need to get out there.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. How much manipulating are you doing on these photos on the computer after they're shot?
I'll be honest, I do a lot of manipulating. That's the part that I enjoy almost the most about photography is taking the captured light, the information that I can save on my camera, which I consider the capturing to be very scientific and less artistic in some ways, and then getting it on the computer, and that's where the art really starts to take form. I have all this information to mess with and make it look like it did in my head. Like I said, if I saw the photo in my head, I can make it that way.
Uh-huh.
But in order to do that, I still have to capture the right light at the right time and the right places.
In that process, I suppose sometimes you might be surprised. You come up with something that you didn't see in your head.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That happens a lot. And then if you can brighten things and darken things and it gives it a whole different feel. And so, I think that's really where the artistic side of it comes in for me is the post-processing part manipulating that information I was able to capture. And I shoot in all raw, obviously, and so it's a very bland photo whenever you start. And so it's meant to be manipulated in digital photography.
Interesting. How about that? And now you mentioned the scientific side of things. How does that manifest in your process?
Yeah, it's a very, the capturing is very structured. I want, you know, there's fractions and ratios of composition that I want to capture, which you could say is artistic as well. I think of it scientifically. But the amount of light that's coming into the lens, getting all the aperture and sensitivity of your sensor all just right. And it, you know, I have a very structured approach to it, and I try to get that information and get it back to my computer. And yes, yeah, so to me, it's very structured. It's less. Yeah, the later in the show is where I feel like the creativity really pops out.
Huh. Interesting. And I think I saw, maybe it was on the Strafe website, the Strafe outdoor clothing website, where there are a few of your photographs there, and along with a description of some of the circumstances of those photos. And at one point you say you plan out your angle. For instance, you have one picture there of a full moon setting over the Maroon Bells.
Yes, that's one of my favorites.
And what makes that one of your favorites?
That specifically was one that I saw in my head well before I got up there. I knew it had to be taken at a certain time. The full moon in late May was whenever that was going to happen. I knew everything would line up. But what was really interesting was that it was an extremely colorful sunrise. That part I couldn't have planned out. You get a different sunrise every day, and it's hard to really predict what you're going to get as far as the special color goes. But I knew that the moon would be there. I knew that if I got up there at that right time, the moon would be behind it. And then I was just gifted with amazing color and soft light on the peaks.
Does that feel like some sort of validation from the universe when you get those kinds of congruences?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a pretty unreal experience where I get very giddy. I get excited. I start laughing to myself, and I just can't believe how perfect things go sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you're paying your dues to get some of those, aren't you? I mean, you're sitting there sometimes for a long time to wait for the shot.
Absolutely. I've sat in one spot for 3 days before waiting.
Really?
And waiting for that moment that I, you know, pictured to come up. And sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes you get out there, and as far as photography goes, it was a waste of time. As far as experience goes, you never regret being there.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes the photo doesn't happen the way I anticipate, and I have to try it again another time whenever things line up.
Huh. So there must be, you must have a bucket list of potential photos.
There's a long list in my head there? Of places to go, things to do. And sometimes the opportunity arises once a year for a photo, for the things to be in the right setting. And so you miss it this year, you have to wait till next year to go back and do it again.
Well, along those lines, did you photograph the eclipse?
I kind of blew it on photographing the eclipse.
Oh,
I wasn't ready. I planned on going to Idaho for it, and then plans fell through for that. So I watched it from here, and photography wise, the experience, yeah. Like I said, sometimes you have to just let photography go and just experience things. And the experience was great. Photography was whatever.
Well, since you specialize in the unique perspective, what do you think a unique perspective of an eclipse would involve?
I was hoping to get to the Sawtooth Range of Idaho because very jagged granite peaks surrounded by lakes. And I was thinking that maybe a dark red landscape would almost make it look a little bit apocalyptic.
Ooh.
So I guess I'll have to wait till the next one.
Well, the next one goes through Cleveland, so you better book your hotel room now.
Yeah,
but that's not the same as the Maroon Bell Snowmass Wilderness, is it?
No, not the same.
But I noticed you have a few cityscapes on your website.
Yeah, I like to play around with it whenever I'm in a city. There's a lot of motion and interesting light to capture in a city as well. I don't feel as connected to a cityscape as I do to a wilderness landscape, but it's fun to mess around with.
You have several photos. I was privileged to live for 20 years in an aspen grove on the backside of Aspen Mountain, and it changed my life. And there are several pictures of aspen groves on your website, and it just took me back. And we were talking about one of them before we came on the air here, and you mentioned something about negative space. And I started thinking about it and realized that's what makes that so incredible of a photograph is there's no negative space. I wonder if you'd talk about negative space and how you play with it. Do you try to avoid it? Is it useful to have it sometimes? Tell me more.
It's a sort of natural thing that my eye looks for is a lack of uninteresting things in a photograph. So I want every aspect of my photograph to be interesting. And so in those aspen groves, I want everything that's going to be in the frame to be something that you want to look at. And so the one you're talking about specifically, I had to walk through lots of different aspen groves to find a place where there was nothing but aspen trunks and golden leaves to look at. So it was sort of a downsloping hill to where the canopy in the background was directly behind the trunks in the foreground. And then
behind that, it was dark, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to have a tripod for pretty much anything I do. That's another aspect that you have to have for those low light situations, the camera can't be moving. Aspen Grove photos are very common, and I try to do something that I haven't seen done before. Otherwise I won't really take that photo.
Huh.
But those are my mom's favorite photos, and so I always have to take them to send to her. And it turns out people end up liking them. So.
Well, we were talking about how you're presenting your photos at the show, and you mentioned that it's under acrylic glass. I wonder if you'd talk a little about that process.
Yeah, so the photos that I have printed are, there's an aluminum backing, 1/8 inch thick. I have the photos printed with laser printing on silver halide paper mounted to the aluminum backing. And then in front of the photo print would be 1/8 inch thick piece of acrylic glass. So the photo is sandwiched between aluminum backing and acrylic glass. And I feel like the glass really brings out the color and the depth of the photo and the details, and it almost creates an image that you feel like you could get sucked into. And I really like that aspect of it. And so it's really it's the most expensive way to do it, but it's the only way that I would like my photos to be presented.
Is that what allows those photos to pop?
Because
on your website, they just pop. They're
amazing. Yeah. And so you take a photo that would pop on screen like that, you add the glass to it, and it gives it even more depth than it had before. And so with my style, I feel like that's the best way to display it, is to bring out that depth as much as possible.
Interesting. In the few minutes we have left here, Devin, I want to talk a little bit about your website. They're really great photos. I like the presentation of it. You've got it divided into 6 sections: black and white, Colorado, huts in the around.
Huts. I love my huts.
You have a night section. That's the section I want to talk about here in a minute. Desert and then travel. So let's talk about some of those night photos. Obviously not completely natural, are they?
No, and that's what I was saying, where you bring out some light that your eyes didn't even see.
Uh-huh.
The Milky Way is constantly just shining light at us, and it's such a faint amount at times that we don't see it, but there's 100 billion stars out there that are
sending
photons right to us, and the camera just sucks those all up. And so you can really bring a lot out of the sky that you didn't even realize was there.
So those photos are taken from one place. So you're taking a picture of the sky, and then you're taking a picture of the landscape under that sky. Is that right?
So on one photo on my website, it's 2 different photos put together, where I took a photo of the sky and then I took a photo of some peaks in Patagonia and put them together. The rest of the night photos were one exposure.
How about that?
That I didn't have to, you know, come and... That's an interesting technique that brings out a lot of cool details that you couldn't do otherwise. But I like the idea that it's all just from absorbing light from one scene.
Uh-huh.
So I try not to stitch. I've done it for one photo that turned out really well. It's one of my favorite photos I've ever taken, but I try not to do that.
Majestic photos.
Thank you.
Mean, you know, the landscape is majestic in and of itself, and then to be underneath 100 billion stars is just eye-opening and mind-blowing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I always say the hardest part of night photography is just getting out of your sleeping bag. The actual photography part isn't that complicated if you just have it all down. But it's really tough to get out of the tent sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Now, are you going out alone when you do these, most of these? Or
I have a few partners that I go pretty reliably with. In the winter, I find it a lot harder to find a partner, somebody who wants to go sleep out in the snow. So I actually end up doing a lot of solo stuff. I'm very, very meticulous about the details of my travel and communicating in a safe way with people back home. I take a satellite texting device so I can let them know what's going on. But I'm not going to not do something just because I can't find someone else to do it with me. And so I end up doing a lot of solo stuff.
Pardon me. I want to plant two seeds in your mind.
Sounds good.
One of them comes from a book that I read, which was a description of a moonless night in a rice paddy in Bali.
Wow.
And it was not cloudy. It was completely clear. So you had that 100 billion star sky reflected in the rice paddy. And then hovering above the water were fireflies.
Wow.
Different heights above the water. So you had that between the stars and the reflection of the stars. And then you also had the reflection of the fireflies in the water. And I read this perfectly described part of this book. And I just went, I see that. Mm-hmm. He described it so well. But looking at your website, I can see that. So if you're ever in a rice paddy,
I'll add it to the list.
Yeah, put it on your list. And the other thing was, one morning I was flying to Denver from Eagle County Airport. It was September. And we got up in the air before the sun came up, and we happened to cross the Continental Divide exactly when the sun hit the divide. So picture it, because, you know, the divide is the first thing that catches the sun, obviously, right? And looking out the windows both directions was this ribbon of light going north and south.
Very special. From,
oh, my God. I don't know how you'd capture that. Maybe you'd have to, I don't know, get a drone or something. Would you be against using a drone in your photos?
There's a lot of conversation about that going on. I prefer not to use a drone. I like to use my feet to get where I need to go. But you can capture a lot of interesting things from the sky that you can't capture from the foot. So, but I've been talking with EcoFlight about getting up in the air and photographing, and I photographed from planes a few times, and you can get some cool perspectives that way as well.
Well, Devin Poole, it's been a pleasure talking with you about your art.
Thanks for having me.
All the best of luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
And I want you to stay tuned, because there is more to come on Express Yourself. Well, that's the Drunken Hearts. The Drunken Hearts are a five-piece from the Vale Valley that are making a splash on the festival circuit around the country, including their very own festival, Yarmany Grass. The band will be dropping a new CD called The Prize very soon, and the Drunken Hearts play a free show on Sunday in Soperus Park, which will conclude the second Sunday concert series for 2017. KD&K will broadcast the show live starting at 4 o'clock. And a few other things going on around town that I want to mention real quick. The 5th Anniversary Salon, curated by Andrea Clearfield and Alia Howe, plays twice in our valley this week. weekend, Saturday night in Carbondale at the Launch Pad and at 7:30, and Sunday evening at the Wheeler at 6. A piano dance collaboration, Borderland Americana, Hobo Stories, how about that? Harp music, poetry, and comedy are included in the celebration show from 11 artists. We'll be talking with one of those artists, Tanya Stavreva, a Bulgarian concert pianist, in several minutes. But first, I want to listen to a piece from Tanya's new CD, Rhythmic Movement, called Danza de la Moza Donosa. Stay with me. You're tuned to Express Yourself on KDNK. That's Tanya Stavreva from her new CD. And as you'll soon hear, the enthusiasm just bubbles out of Tanya Stavreva almost as quickly as her fingers move across the piano keyboard. One New York critic calls Tanya a fully formed and fearsomely talented pianist. Another calls her a very unique pianist, combining genuine quality with a refreshing approach to programming. She is also renowned around the world for having some of the most precise fingering of any of the 20-something generation of pianists, bar none. I spoke to Tanya yesterday as she was packing for her first trip to Colorado and the Roaring Fork Valley. Joining the program now is Tanya Stavreva. Hello, Tanya.
Hello. Hello from New York.
You are paying our valley a visit for two concerts, one at the Launch Pad in Carbondale and one at the Wheeler on Sunday. So is this your first time to the Roaring Fork Valley?
It is the very first time coming there, yes, and my very first time in the state of Colorado, so I'm very excited. I've heard so many stories, and I've heard how beautiful it is and how a lot of people even go on vacation in the mountains. So I do hope to get some chance to visit and see places, not just to perform and rehearse. So we'll see if I'll have an opportunity, but it's very difficult to describe how excited I am.
Well, you are from Bulgaria, and that in itself is exotic. Tell me a little bit, and evidently you were began with music as a very young girl. So tell me a little bit about your life and your upbringing and your musical experiences in Bulgaria.
Of course, I will be happy to. Well, I was born and raised in Bulgaria. That's my home country. And I started to play at the age of 4. So the way my parents told me the story is that we often went to visit friends who had a piano. And my father is a musician, so I come from a musical family, which helped because my parents, I'm so grateful to them about that. They found the best teachers. They knew what it means to work with a experienced instructor and what are the levels of different types of teachers. So having the right teacher at early age is essential and very important just for any kid. And I was very lucky to have my parents' support. So when we came to visit these friends with the piano, they always had a hard time taking me away. I would just go and play random notes. And sometimes when we had to go and leave, they would have to literally pull me with a lot of hard work in order to take me away from the piano. So they thought that I could start lessons already. And that's how it all started. I mean, they did plan on having me take lessons at childhood age, but they didn't plan exactly when. They didn't plan that it has to be age 4 exactly. I just feel that since I was already 3 and I had that interest, they thought, why not try?
And why the piano? Why not the violin or the bassoon?
Isn't that so interesting? That is an interesting question, because my father was a violinist and conductor, and he never played the piano. I mean, he played actually in Bulgaria every instrument. Like, if you're in a music school, every instrument that is not a piano major is required to learn a piano as a secondary instrument. So these people, they don't learn piano like pianists, but they have to learn basic skill at the piano. So my father did play a little bit of piano, but not as a pianist. However, I don't know. I think my father probably didn't like the standing, because the violinist, they have to stand when they perform a soloist, and he had problems with his health and with his legs, and maybe that's one of the reasons. But also, I think I did click with the piano. I think I remember trying a violin. I remember that, but I think the teacher suggested the piano that was a little more natural maybe with me. I wish I could remember exactly everything, but I was just so young.
Well, do you remember hating the piano like so many kids who have to take piano lessons?
I don't remember hating the piano, but I remember wanting to play a lot of difficult pieces at early age, and my teacher often would say, oh, no, this is for a later time, or you need to. Actually, one of the things I really appreciate very much about my teacher is that she would give her students only pieces that really reflected their age and maturity. Like, for example, if it came to working on a Chopin ballet, she wouldn't give that kind of a piece to a 12-year-old kid, even if they have the technique to handle that, because certain music requires a lot of emotion and a lot of certain level of life experience when it comes to playing music that involves life and death and love and passion. You just can't explain how certain phrase that describe a picture of love is at 12 years old,
right,
or a picture of war, because those are themes a little more mature for a child's mind.
So you also attended some national Bulgarian National School of Music, is that correct?
Yes, the National Music School, Dobrin Petkov in Plovdiv. So I was born in Sofia, but I was raised in Plovdiv. And that's one of the top schools for music in Bulgaria. There is also National Music School in Sofia. So, yes, the program is pretty intensive. And I often joke that I graduated from the National Military Music School in Bulgaria. So, but I'm very grateful for all of that training. It was absolutely unique and great, and I think it helped me further just with moving here in the U.S. It gave me amazing foundation. So, it's a special school that every kid would need to audition in order to get in, and it goes from first grade to 12th grade. So,
How did you make it over to this country? Because you're now a resident of New York City, I guess.
I'm a resident of New York City, yes. I came to study after I graduated from the music school in Boston. That's where I completed my degree in piano performance. And then after that, I got invited from a management company to work as an artist. So I did switch from student visa to artist visa, which allowed me to perform professionally in the U.S. anywhere, and get paid for that. And now, actually, I just got approved for the artist green card. It's called EB1 application. So that's also very exciting.
Yeah, just in time.
Now I'm officially one of those new immigrants.
How about that? Well,
to say that I'm an immigrant.
You got that just in time, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. How about that? And so now you're embarked on a concert career, and you, I guess, travel the world. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. I'm getting more and more engagements, and I'm very excited. It's all absolutely exciting and wonderful. And like, for example, that trip to Colorado, it's something new that I'm looking forward to. And yeah, I really can't wait. I'm taking the flight tomorrow, tomorrow morning.
Oh, okay. I read a little piece on you on the Cross-Eyed Pianist, an English website, and you talk a little bit about acting classes. And I thought, well, you know, that's interesting. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about what acting classes did for you as a pianist.
I hope not to. You know, I'm kind of chatty sometimes, so you have to let me know when to stop because I could talk for hours. Well, I had interest in acting toward my early high school. I believe I was about 14 or 13 years old, and my parents didn't let me go to acting school. I mean, I was already in music school, so that was pretty intensive, and there was no way I could do both. It was just not manageable, even though I did an audition on my own and I did got in. It's just that I cannot do that without parents' permission. So that's kind of a secret, but I did take private acting classes a little bit secretly from my parents. And they were just private classes. It wasn't an actual theater program, but I did learn a lot. All of these classes started to help me with my literature classes in school. So I was writing essays better because I had to work on analyzing a character. I had to work on analyzing the piece. And I read a lot of Stanislavski. And I just feel that all of this experience, even though it was just about 3-4 years of experience on the side, it gave me, it opened up my imagination. And I think it helps me as a pianist. And I feel that every pianist, in a way, should take an acting class because working on a musical piece, it's like working on the role of an actor. You're bringing a story and you're bringing different characters. And in music, you could even be the director, all the actors, and all of everything, in a way, together that can make every story a little bit more alive.
Interesting. So what I hear you saying is that there are two parts. There's learning the piano, the fundamentals and the basics and, you know, everything about the actual playing of a piece. And then there's the performance or the interpretation of the piece. And both are important to you, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I think when you're a kid and when you're growing up, you are establishing yourself as a personality, and it's important to learn all the fundamentals and all the rules, and it's important later on when you're developing as an artist to know who you are, what do you want to deliver to the world, and what is your art about. That's very essential because often musicians practice because their teacher tell them to do something, or I play this piece because my teacher told me, or I play this piece because my friends told me. But it's important, once the basic school training is over, for an artist to know what kind of area they specialize, who is the real self. And I know that every artist continues to develop and continues to learn more just about everything, about life, about themselves. And often art is a kind of a projection on that.
Interesting. Well, that's a very interesting approach, and I think it might be the reason I discovered that you're not afraid to take classical music to unconventional audiences for classical music, and the opposite too. You're not afraid to bring different elements into a classical performance. For example, you've played with the Dresden Dolls.
Well, the classical music, actually, it's kind of a separate community from the world. And there are more and more artists, classical, that do this lately. And when I first did that in 2009 with Amanda Palmer, first of all, I met Amanda Palmer in person through a friend. I used to live in Boston at that time. So I did meet her at a party. They had electric keyboards, and I did play a little bit to her. So that was a great introduction. And Amanda loves piano playing, and she often jokes that she never liked practicing. She always likes making things on her own. But she understands when a concert pianist is practicing how different it is than her style, for example. And she's an amazing artist. And she loves classical music, and she admires a lot of classical composers and pianists who have the determination to practice in this way. So she wanted to show that to her audience, and I thought it would be fun. But in 2009, nobody around me was doing this, and a lot of my colleagues actually even said that that was a dangerous idea, that it could affect my career, that it's not sort of appropriate for a pianist to do this. And I just felt that it's not just a good exposure for me, but it's also a good exposure for the music itself to hear, to find new audience. And I think a lot of the people heard for the first time who Finisterre was. They never heard of Finisterre. Like if I mentioned the word classical music, they would think of Mozart or Beethoven, the more traditional type of composers. But if I mention some of the modern composers, some people have no clue that they are actually classical composers. And unless the person comes from a musical family, just a lot of people, they don't know about that.
You're also known for playing with Living Colors drummer Will Calhoun.
Well, I needed him. He is the guest artist on the last track of the album, because the album is called Rhythmic Movement. The drums underline this idea. And first of all, I just want to clarify that I'm not the biggest fan of taking a classical piece and changing it into something or making it into something different than what the composer did. Traditionally, I like to keep classical music the way it is, because to me, classical music is like sacred music. This is just what the composer said, and that's how it is. So with Finisterre's last movement of the sonata, that's kind of an exception. But he also worked with Emerson, Lake and Palmer. They did. They took the last movement of his piano concerto, and they made a rock and roll kind of version. They improvised on it. But they wanted to meet the composer in person. So they traveled all the way to meet the composer. I was reading and Googling about this. And he said that this is exactly how his music should be played.
Huh.
So certain movements and parts of his music are very dance-like. And I feel that the idea with the drums underlines the element of rhythm. And it came very naturally. And Will also started kind of from far away and a little more in the background. And then he eventually built up the rhythms and the drums into the piece, especially toward the end. So I think it was very kind of nice how gently he enters at the beginning and then builds up the rhythmic atmosphere. But I also have that same track of the piece. Track 7 is the original version of the piece for solo piano. And track 14 is the same piano piece, but with the drummer.
Oh, okay. I watched that. I didn't catch that. So thank you for enlightening me on that.
Yes.
I did watch the video on your website, which, by the way, is TanyaStavreva.com, of you and Will playing together. And it was really fascinating to me to watch the interplay of the drums and you on the piano and how you were looking at each other and taking cues. Of course, he was using brushes and lots of cymbal work on that, but it melded perfectly, and it was very surprising because you wouldn't think a drum set and a grand piano would mix, but it does very well to great effect.
It's a very rare combination, and I got this idea kind of by accident. The first drummer I worked with was a drummer from a very famous metal band. His name is Dave Lombardo. And I did meet him in 2011 at one of the Grammy Awards editions. And I had that idea because I admired the technical aspect. And metal type of drumming is very different than classical percussion. So I was very interested in the technical approach, which was mind-blowing to me. And but in terms of metal, the yelling part is the part that I have a difficulty handling in general. But everything else in terms of instrumentation is interesting to me. And I already had a friend with a rock band back in Boston, so I got used to the distorted sound. And then I could hear how certain bands, they play more with more clarity, or other bands, they play a little bit more like noise. or so I could distinguish that difference, because coming from classical background, at the beginning, everything with distortion sounded to me like noise. So I feel that a lot of classical listeners who are not used to rock music, they can't appreciate certain type of rock music because of the distorted sound. But I already have experience listening on distortion. So I have appreciation for many music styles, for jazz, for classical, for rock, for even some pop, and many, many other genres of music. I follow a lot of different
and that's reflected.
Artists.
That's reflected on your CD. I mean, you have, let's see, you have some modern Russian and Bulgarian. You have some Argentinian composers on there. You have a couple that verge on jazz and one that's sort of bluesy.
Yes, so that was by Mason Bates, a blues fantasy. So the
yes.
trick there was to pretend as if I'm creating everything at the same moment, as if I'm improvising, but at the same time to play everything exactly the way it's written. So often when musicians play written music, kind of sounds like written music, while the composer wanted the piece to sound, to be played the way it's written, but to sound as if it's improvised. So that was a lot of fun, and I did have experience listening to a lot of blues and jazz already, so I naturally felt the groove in a way, and it's a wonderful idea, and it's a wonderful tribute to Alan Lomax. And at the very end of that piece, I have to play with a song by Alan Lomax called Dollar Mime. And the tapping and the clapping and the singing you would hear at the very end, this is basically called electroacoustic, adding electronic elements to the piano piece.
Huh.
That's how Mason composed the piece originally. But at the Van Cliburn competition, where it was... so that piece was actually on one of the Van Cliburn competition editions. It was accepted. It was, I think, a winner of the composers competition, so the pianist did perform that as well, but nobody performed it with the electronic element. Everybody played just the music for the piano part, so Mason does like to have that electronic element added as well, so that was fun. I just wanted to add that when me and Will worked on the piano and drums piece, he wanted to do more stuff like that. He even wanted me to find more pieces. And then I was thinking about it because it was so exciting that if I actually looked into more music by composers who treat the piano as a percussive instrument, such as Prokofiev, Bartok, even Morgan Estera, a lot of the piano pieces somehow, it didn't feel right to me to add drums or to make another album with classical composers and out drums. I just felt like this particular piece by Morgan Estera was an exception. And I didn't want to create another album that it would sound like that, but then that particular piece by Hinostera would be the best thing. Of course, I would want the project to evolve and to take the audience on a journey, but I also felt that it didn't speak to me naturally so much. So I decided that if I collaborate with Will again on piano and drum projects, it will be more original music. So I would compose the music for the piano, and he would add drums to it. I think that way would be, to me, more appropriate moving forward with something like that, rather than just looking into more classical compositions.
There are also two tracks on your CD that you compose. So you are also not just a performer, but a composer. Tell me a little bit about that part of your music.
Well, I'm always very modest about my composing, and I'm always very, how to say, blushing a little bit about it, because pianists in classical music are not really expected to compose much. There are very few of us doing that, and it kind of happened by accident, and it never came to my mind because I've never been encouraged at school or conservatories or by teachers, because I already was a piano major when I was school, and pianists don't study composition. Pianists don't study improvisation. We just never study those things in school, even though we have millions of other musical classes. And since I played so much music through my hands, it's easier to, to figure out how to compose a simple piece. I mean, it's not easy to compose a symphony, let's say, or an opera. So I was working in 2012 with Animal Tear Theater Company on off of Broadway, and the director, that was actually the name of the play, was The Tempest by William Shakespeare. So the director was having a modern adaptation of the play, and I had to play modern classical music to match the modern adaptation. So that was a very unique idea, and a lot of classical compositions matched very well certain monologues, because Shakespeare's language is like music itself, and it has rhythm. So we had to choose the right modern pieces that have similar rhythms to match the rhythm of the Shakespeare. So that was a very interesting idea, experiment. It worked out great. But there were a couple of pieces that I proposed that the director somehow didn't connect with them. He felt that the title of the piece sounds great for what it is, but the music didn't really sound like what he wanted to sound. And sometimes even the tempo didn't sound well. So, for example, he wanted to use the beginning of the slower movement of Ravel's Piano Concerto in a monologue. And he told me, can you just cut this shorter because we need to end a little earlier? Or sometimes he would say, can you just play this faster because we just need it that way for the monologue? And I often said, well, look, this is how the composer wrote this, and as a pianist, it's important to express this in this way, and I need to do my rubato. So as a musician, I didn't want certain things to kind of not sound musical enough to help the actors, and I said, you know what, if I actually compose my own thing, it might sound exactly the way you want it, and we just need 45 seconds of music for a particular scene. So I just thought, why don't I just compose this, and then I can do it exactly the way he wants it, and I don't have to feel guilty that I'm not keeping all the composer's markings and endings. And
that's interesting.
So that's how I started composing. I just figured out it was easier with the theater play. And then later I decided that I could compose a little longer and make it my own piece. And then everywhere I played the piece, a lot of people came to talk to me that they really liked Rhythmic Movement. The track number one, that was my first original composition, official original composition. And then I decided to compose some more pieces, and that's how I got into it.
I also understand, Tanya, that you like to meditate and that it's important to you as a musician. Talk a little bit about that.
Especially living in New York City, everybody should meditate here. yes, it helps me relax, definitely, and helps with concentration. I had a friend who was doing meditation. Then a book by Deepak Chopra came in my hands that I also got inspired about. I took some classes, and that's how I got into it. And I would say I meditate pretty regularly, but I do try to do it sometimes when I travel, it's hard. Sometimes when I'm very busy, it's hard. It requires certain focus. But again, I do try to do it every day. And if I don't have the time to do 20 minutes or 30 minutes, even 5 or 10 minutes, it's still something to do. And I think it's very valuable, actually.
The last thing I want to ask you before I let you go here, Tanya, what will people hear at the salons this weekend in Carbondale and Aspen? What's your part of the program? What are you playing?
Well, I will be performing pieces that I composed. Also, I will be performing pieces by Bulgarian composers and music from the album, the Billboard Top 10 album, Rhythmic Movement. I will be performing also music by Hinostera, Alberto Ginastera, and Federico Mompou, a Catalonian composer.
Wow, so you have several pieces.
Yes, yes. I mean, each artist has about 15 minutes on stage.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to show different sides of my musicality, and that's why I choose shorter pieces.
Well, Tanya Stavreva, I want to thank you for spending half an hour with us here, and thank you so much. Tanya Stavreva performs tomorrow night in Carbondale at the Launchpad at 7:30 and Sunday night at the Wheeler Opera House at 6. You can procure tickets at saloncarbondale.eventbrite.com, and you can get more information by calling Alia at 970-309-2582. 2. That does it for another Express Yourself. Thank you for tuning in. Stay tuned for the news, and please remember to go out there and express yourself.